Statecraftiness is produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the lands of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We acknowledge their elders, past and present. We're going to be going off on our adventures to the American-speaking and French-speaking Pacific in the next and last two episodes of Statecraftiness. But in this episode, we wanted to focus on the major threat in the Pacific, climate change.
The Pacific Island nations know better than anyone that averting the worst effects of climate change is going to save lives. Or put it another way, if we don't, we're going to lose a lot of lives.
It's been extremely positive, the reception that Australia has received here. There's a recognition that my government is committed to climate action.
China, on its part, will continue to make our own efforts and take concrete steps to support Pacific Island countries in coping with climate change.
Almost all of them, if not all of us, have small islands that are being exposed to climate change. So we have sensationalized the issue to our major partner in Japan, was also PAM. We have also sensationalized the issue to Australia.
Most of the voices you will know, United States President Joe Biden, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape. It's a real and existential threat all over the world. But Pacific Island nations are at the eye of the issue. And now the Pacific has become such a hot geopolitical region, climate change has become the front and center issue in statecraft and the competition for influence. In this episode, we visit two of the main places in which statecraft around climate change takes place, on the ground itself and in the great conference halls of diplomacy. And we began by asking someone who has deep experience in both these milieus.
This is Satendra Prasad. I'm the climate lead for EPT Associates based in Canberra. Prior to this, I was Fiji's ambassador to the United Nations, US and Canada, based largely in New York, where I had also a dual-headed role on leading on the climate and oceans and SDG work on behalf of government of Fiji, and pretty long career in development generally with EPT, with World Bank, with the UK DFID before that, and I'm from Fiji. Obviously, everyone in Pacific has had lifetime encounters with climate change in one way or the other. But personally, everyone in Fiji, which is part of Melanesia, has grown up with tropical cyclones. And the startling thing about the last couple of decades has been that tropical cyclones have become much more frequent, much more intense than they used to be as a child. And the hurt and the trauma of cyclones, I think, has affected everyone growing up in a country like Fiji or Solomon Islands or Vanuatu, for that matter, because I come from a relatively poor country, mostly from a relatively poor household. And most households in this category, when a cyclone hits, you tend to lose much or most of whatever little you have, and then you have to dedicate years, if not decades, to get back to where your family may have been. So that's a sort of story of our life. The second part of growing up in this context is often, and I don't want to sound pessimistic, a sense of helplessness. There's so much you can do. If you come from an agricultural background, you have lost your crops to the cyclone or flooding or excessive rain. It is not that you walk in tomorrow morning and replant whatever has been lost, because you have to wait for the next rains and the next season. So it's like you are set back for a couple of years, right? And so there's a sense of helplessness that comes out of it, and probably also a helplessness that everyone around you is in the same category. It is not as if some are better off and some are worse off, and these are by and large poor governments, and there's only so much that your governments can do to give you a helping hand at moments like this. It's quite painful to see the trauma of society is going through repeated shocks arising from climate. But across the Pacific, this is one experience. There are so many different experiences, including from a sea level rise and the slow impact that it has when you lose your agricultural lands, your farming lands, your gardens, and slowly the water sources as well, to droughts, which were pretty rare phenomena in this part of the world, much more frequent now. Extreme water shortages, and anyone who understands and appreciates the size and the breadth of the Pacific, as Gordon, you will appreciate, you know, when you have water shortage in one part of a country such as Kiribati on the Ellis Island, you have to effectively ship water from another part of Kiribati, and that's probably 2,000 miles of shipping. And by the time the boat turns back, it has to refill and go right back. So just the scale and the diversity of the climate challenges are so huge. If these are not the front lines of climate change, then I don't know what the front lines are.
Wonderful, Satya. Thank you so much. I want to just move the story on to when you were Fijian ambassador to the United Nations, and you also spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. You would have been there when the first Pacific Island Summit would have been held between the White House and Pacific Island nations. How are Pacific Island nations using the issue of climate when they are carrying out their diplomacy, whether it be in New York at the United Nations or with the United States in Washington, D.C.?
I think my one word answer is in the Pacifics, at least in my term, in how I woke up to my job, there was climate and there was everything else. Probably climate is 70-80% of what you do. Everything else is in that ratio. And that reflects what Pacific leaders have been saying persistently for several decades. Climate is by far the most important of their challenges and therefore priorities. And second, that reflects what Pacific civil society and communities across the Pacific are saying. There are many other things that are important to them, but this is by far the most important and pressing of the challenges. So in terms of the time and the focus of diplomacy, that comes through. And I don't think Pacific Island distinguishes between large and middle size and other countries, because this priority cuts across. And so at times it is frustrating, you know, when other countries engage with the Pacific, then the priorities that other countries have in and around the Pacific may be more security focused, may be more other focused, and the Pacific is talking about climate and development, climate and poverty, climate and its impact on women and disabled, climate and its impact on agriculture and food security, while others may be talking about, you know, geopolitics and so on. When you're in rooms like this, there appears to be a disconnect, two parallel conversations and talking at each other rather than, you know, learning and listening. But my own impression is that over time, this has been changing. I think most countries are beginning to appreciate with different levels of understanding and with different levels of empathy that this is by far the most important priority, whether they are in very, very big forums like global forums and all countries are together, or more private settings where, you know, there's one country and US, for example, a group of countries and US. Much of the discussion will inevitably come on climate change. I think with the U.S., for example, it's a superpower, and obviously the U.S.'s interests in the Pacific go beyond beyond climate, and we understand that. Everyone understands that fully, and that U.S. has its own national interest in the Pacific, being part of the Pacific, Hawaii, Guam, American Samoa, etc., and these are unique interests, but nevertheless, that the areas in which even the security perspective and the climate perspective can intersect.
In this podcast, we're interested in influence. So let me ask you a question related to that. If you're an Australian, an American, a Chinese diplomat, contractor, or some other tool of statecraft, is having a serious, credible climate policy, you know, commitment to emissions being cut, commitment to loss and damage, commitment to infrastructure that is climate resilient. Is that a prerequisite?
I'm no longer a diplomat, so presumably I'm a bit off the hook on needing to be very diplomatic. But nevertheless, having a good climate policy should have nothing to do with the Pacific and what Pacific is saying. It is just a very good domestic policy to have a great climate policy. My first starting point in response to that is that all countries, not because they've agreed internationally global climate commitments to raising the bar on climate, but it is just very, very good domestic politics and domestic policy to have solid climate policies. And the more I think about this, the more I think the climate will in time become good politics as well. It is about jobs. It is about creating opportunities for domestic businesses. It is about creating new export markets. It is giving a lot more hope to a younger generation that they will be developing new skills, developing entirely new skill sets that were just not there 10, 20 years ago, and having fantastic futures. When countries therefore engage with Pacific, given where its priorities are, if these domestic policies are good, it will reflect on the relationship. It will be organic rather than a facade that is put to have improved relations with the Pacific. Though having said that, I do not think that the warmth of relations between Pacific and its partners depends so much on climate. I mean, on the climate commitments they bring, but it does contribute to that. A whole range of other factors influence the relationship between countries, with Australia, with New Zealand. Of course, we are part of the Pacific Island Forum setting, regional settings, and so many Pacific Islanders, including Fijians, live in Australia and have made their homes in Australia, SFI.
I want to end by testing your powers of eloquence and your powers of concision by asking you to reflect upon the COP process, the Conference of the Parties, where states gather annually to monitor and review the implementation of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And this event we see every year. You know, last year it was in Dubai. Before that, it was in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. Before that, it was in Glasgow. This year, 2024, it will be in Azerbaijan. And these events don't happen in the Pacific, and yet decisions here affect the Pacific, and also how states act in these meetings, I imagine, impact upon their standing in the Pacific. I've never been, I mean, I've just sort of looked at the images that come across my screen about it, and it just strikes me as this giant extravaganza, you know, tens of thousands of people flying in, lots of events. Kind of has a feeling of being a cross between a peace conference and a university freshers week. You've been to these COP meetings a bunch of times. I know there's thousands of words written about the COP meetings, but what three words would you use to describe them?
Okay, this is a hard one. I might change the words. If you've been on the Pacific side, one is frustration and the slowness, right? And absence of sincerity, I think. It's not three words, but what's insincere? What is the word?
I think we could let you away with five words here.
Yeah, but I would want to end on a positive thing. At the same time, the dominant thread and the dominant feeling and sentiments in COP that I find is there's a lot of people who talk about speed, there's a lot of people who talk about scale, and there's a lot of people who talk about impact. And I'd want to close with those three words.
And to find out more about what happened within the bowels of COP itself, we asked a Papua New Guinean lawyer who has been representing his nation in negotiations on climate.
My name is Oliver Nobitau, and I'm the Pacific Research Fellow at the Lowy Institute. In my previous role, I worked as the Senior Legal Officer within the Office of the State Solicitor of Papua New Guinea's Department of Justice and Attorney General. I practice primarily in international law, with my portfolio looking at covering areas relating to climate change and national security. Growing up, I've seen the impacts of climate change affect us not only within the urban centers, but in the rural centers as well. When you don't have as many opportunities to go back home frequently, you tend to see the differences in the landscape. Noting that we have a strong connection to the land, every time you go back, you notice the differences. This can range from a lot of the favorite foods that you like to eat that are not available anymore. The watering holes that you used to swim in that used to be so deep have been drying up. The weather itself changes a lot. Currently, what used to be rainy season is heavily delayed, but when it does come by, it's a lot shorter, but there's heavier rainfall, which causes a lot of flooding around the areas.
Great, thank you. And you're also the first example of an intergenerational guest on the podcast, because your father, Joseph, who I worked very closely with in Bougainville, was a guest on season one of State Craftiness. So great to keep it in the family.
That was an excellent episode, yeah.
You're a very good diplomat, Oliver. I wanted to ask you about your portfolio and what it's like to influence other nations and be influenced by other nations inside the COP as a member of the Pacific Islands delegation. Can you take us behind the scenes and give us a flavor about what it's like?
The COP meetings are really nothing short of hectic. I think if you look at the numbers, each COP itself registers something north of 30,000 participants. I believe if you look at the numbers for COP in Dubai, there was about 97,000 registered attendees. So if you were passerby and you didn't know it was COP, you'd be excused if you thought it was like a full-on festival. There's just so much going on. Attending COP as a whole is an experience, so I can't really say that, you know, I would have a best story for there, but to an extent, it's always mind-blowing the first COP that you go to, especially being from a smaller developing country. The experience is something to relish. Some COPs even have like a number of celebrities that attend, and they really lift the profile of the event. During Glasgow COP26, I remember, I think within the space of 10 minutes past my workstation, you'd see walking people like those POTUS, Prince Charles as he then was, even Leonardo DiCaprio. So it's a lot to take in when you go for these COPs. I guess on the professional side, when you're going to these negotiating rooms, towards the end of the conference specifically, there's always, the parties are under pressure to sort of reach a consensus on the texts and develop the wording that will go before the conference of parties for acceptance. And that's really when it gets strenuous, but it's also when it gets the adrenaline pumping. And I think that's one experience that a lot of the party delegates enjoy. Around that time is also when most of the delegates are sharing the same sentiments that either they want to leave early or they just want to go back home. They're tired of it by the end of the second week. I guess for anyone who's sort of practicing in the climate change space, attending COP is definitely a pinnacle in a career. Your days would usually begin with like coordination meetings within the negotiating groups. PNG, for instance, they are represented from in the Pacific Small Island Developing States, as well as the Alliance of Small Island States and the Group of 77 in China. So this is a large coalition of developing countries. You would then take your positions into the working groups and make interventions on behalf of your country, or if you're chairing a negotiating group on behalf of them as well. So there's a lot going on here. During the COP sessions, you would get home pretty late, close to midnight, and then you have to wake up early in the mornings and then get to your coordination meetings. There's not much time to sleep, to be honest, and that's why I think towards the end of it, everyone just gets tired of it and they want to go home. It's a very strenuous activity, to be honest.
I mean, this certainly is an activity that rewards people who don't sleep a lot. I mean, I'm thinking of this former United States diplomat, famous practitioner of statecraft, Richard Holbrooke. And he was famous for, among other things, negotiating the Dayton Accords that ended the conflict in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Because he was able to get by without very much sleep, he outlasted everyone in the negotiations. And everyone was so exhausted by the end of the negotiations, so the story goes, that they said, okay, I'm happy to agree to whatever you've put forward. And I guess thinking about Holbrooke brings up the question of language and what language we're using when we negotiate. Because when Holbrooke was negotiating with parties in the Balkans, he was a native English speaker. They were speaking or using second or third languages in the negotiations, even with translation. I mean, you're a native English speaker, Oliver, but I often wonder if you were someone that only spoke Marshallese or Tetun or French, how you would fare in the COP negotiations. I mean, it'd be great to get your reflections on the inbuilt advantage of English in these halls of statecraft.
I think you're exactly right on that. I mean, the negotiations are primarily conducted in English. So being able to comprehend the language is quite tantamount to being in the negotiation rooms. You don't necessarily have to have a fancy English accent, but being able to understand it really is key. It becomes quite important when you're negotiating text, and sometimes the negotiations can really boil down to arguing whether or not to include one single term, noting that one word could have an obscure meaning for each individual party. So I understand that a lot of, especially from the developing country side, where English is not the first language, it can be quite intimidating for the participants to make the interventions. And it really requires you to be brave and take that step into speaking and advocating for your country's interests. And I guess, you know, on that topic of the difficulty with, I guess, conducting the negotiations in English, I think it's a good segue into the broader capacity issues that are being faced by the developing countries. So that is the main issue that a lot of them face in terms of capacity gaps. But this is having to do with both the numbers of people that they have available on a delegation to follow each of the thematic areas, because there are so many different negotiations and work streams going on.
And you're from a country, Papua New Guinea, where there's been lots of statecraft emanating from and being beamed into. I mean, you've got the climate negotiations, but you've also got a security treaty that the United States negotiated with Papua New Guinea. You've got a security framework that Australia's negotiated with Papua New Guinea over the last year. And you've been involved in all these negotiations. And I'd love to get a little bit of a sense from you about the personal and professional dynamics that go on whenever you're negotiating large, complex arrangements like these.
Yeah, okay. So I'll try to answer this in, I guess, a number of different ways. I'll try and answer first thing, I guess, in the climate change context, in terms of this, and then the COP one, and then I can go into sort of more like a personal experience of what I've seen. I guess, like, in terms of being from a developing country and knowing that there's a lot of statecraft going on, if I look at things in the lens of the COP, in terms of the general negotiating positions that you would have being from a developed country, you tend to really appreciate the negotiating groups that you're part of. So EOSIS, PCIDS, Group of 77 in China. But that's not to say that at these COPs, sharing an isolated view is a disadvantage. In terms of my personal experience in other areas as well, and with all the statecraft and how people see us, it depends. I think it's more of a personality thing. I wouldn't associate this approach with a particular country. I think the clearest example that I can share is sort of the dichotomy between the Australians and the Americans. The Australians we've been familiar with for a very long time, and the Americans coming in as something very new. And it seems to be more of like a personal approach that people take. And I'll use the example of negotiating with the Defense Cooperation Agreement. The Americans from the Department of State on that, oh man, there's a blackout. So, I'll backtrack on that one. So, in comparison, the negotiations with the Department of State lawyers from the United States, they came into the DCA negotiations understanding that they weren't fully aware of the lay of the land. And sort of the first few iterations of the negotiations with us, they had spent a lot of time just understanding the frameworks that we have to operate in. And they really done their homework. And towards the end of it, they were able to come back and really have a strong position. But that was because they were able to ask the questions and know to really do their homework on how PNG is intended to operate. And I think that, you know, from a professional standpoint, and I guess noting the craft that you have to develop when you're in these negotiating rooms, you have a lot of respect for how people approach things in that manner.
Hi there, aloha. My name is Richard Cochran, the Executive Director of the Tuvalu Climate Action Network based here in Tuvalu, and I would like to extend our warm greetings to you. Get ready for an exciting journey as I take you on an audio tour from Funafuti, the capital of Tuvalu, the fourth smallest country in the world. In the midst of Tuvalu's rising global attention, I've captured the essence of statecraft sites just for you. Fasten your seatbelts. It's time to embark on this Tuvaluan adventure. Are you ready? Let's dive in.
As Richard was telling me, Tuvalu is so little known by some border officials that they simply don't believe that it exists when he is passing through their country to negotiate and to lobby for his country's rights to exist. When he passed through the United Arab Emirates a few years back, the customs officer hauled him into a waiting room for questioning before someone consulted an atlas to find this low-lying atoll nation of 11,000 in the Central Pacific. Tuvalu is a nation that exists now, but it may not exist in 100 years because of climate change. And its precarious position has made the country the subject of intense interest from the major powers. Last year, the prime ministers of Australia and Tuvalu announced a far-reaching treaty between the two countries known as the Falapeli Union. The union provides a pathway to migration to Australia, supports climate adaptation work, and also has a heavy security dimension. As per the terms of the treaty, which is yet to be ratified by either parliament, Australia has veto power over any security or defence deal that Tuvalu may seek to enter with any other country. Earlier this year, Tuvalu held parliamentary elections and is now in the arc light of attention as to whether it will switch recognition from Taiwan to the People's Republic of China. When we were recording this podcast in mid-February, it was still recognizing Taiwan. And yet most people opining and prognosticating on the questions of Tuvalu have never been to Tuvalu. Richard wanted to give us a sense of what the real Tuvalu was like. And so, armed with a voice recorder and some fuel in his trusty motorbike, off he went. And his first stop was at one time one of the busiest diplomatic sites in the Pacific.
I'm standing here at the Queen Elizabeth Park in Tuvalu, a reclaimed land boasting dimensions of approximately 80 meters in width and 200 meters in length. Standing proudly at the forefront is the Thomas Ipupua Convention Center, TPCC, erected on this reclaimed expanse. Notably, TPCC hosted the 50th Pacific Island Forum Leaders in August 2019. From here, you can still see remnants of old seawalls, recalling a cherished landmark for swimming and fishing for the locals. Queen Elizabeth Park reflects a blend of progress and nostalgia.
Richard's next stop was a site of old warcraft and a reminder that Tuvalu has often played a role in competition for influence among the major powers.
I'm standing here at the northern tip of Funafuti, facing the Tuvalu Maritime Training Institute, where we can see remnants of a World War II gun station built by Americans are now exposed in the water, about 30 meters from its original inland location. This starkly illustrates the impact of sea level rise and coastal erosion, revealing what was once inland, now submerged in water.
Next stop was an office, the very existence of which is at the center of today's recognition tussles.
Here at the Taiwan Embassy stands adjacent to a historical burrow pits, once utilized by the Americans for construction of the airstrip. This two-story embassy building displays proudly its flag in their compound. It stands surrounded by local residents, where its entrance facing towards the ocean side, and it is far from the lagoon.
And then it was off to the only other embassy in Tuvalu, the one that has been most recently opened, that of Australia.
Here at the Australian Embassy is conveniently located within the Tuvalu Telecom facility, just a 2-minute stroll from the Funafuti International Airport. As you approach the entrance from the main road, the embassy's flag proudly flies atop the main building, facing the roadside and overlooking the nearby Pulaka and taro plantation.
I had been really enjoying listening to Richard's dispatches from across the atoll in Funafuti, but his last message made me well up.
As I conclude this heartfelt postcard for you, Gordon, my joy in sharing the beauty of Tuvalu with you is tinged with melancholy. For amidst the longing and sadness, a piece of our cherished heritage has slipped away. Yet, my earnest wish is that through this shared moment, you will not only carry our voice, but also help forge strong diplomatic bonds with your beloved American and other nations that hold Tuvalu in their hearts, just as they do for their own. May the echoes of our shared story resonate, wavering in tapestry of understanding and love that transcends borders and stand as a testimony to enduring spirits of Tuvalu. Vaftai.
A few days later, and with the internet connection more stable than usual, Richard and I had a quick conversation. Richard is a cheery guy, but I found him in an understandably melancholic mood. His words uninflected by any diplomaties like climate adaptation or resilience.
We Tuvaluans, we almost contributed nothing to greenhouse gases, and yet we receive the severe impacts of this. It is not our choice. And for now, like Tuvaluans, we are just here and brace ourselves for whatever impacts that comes in. But that's not from our doings. Like, it's not from our production. And yet the wealthiest countries, they enjoy their profits from their production. And yet we are suffering the consequences of their profits, of their mass production. Like recently, we have this new reclaimed land. And this reclaimed land is like a 2.8 meters from the normal ground of Tuvalu. So it's just very close to my house. And just like 15 meters behind our house, we have this reclaimed land. We see that this reclaimed land is a bit higher than the normal land itself. But for the rate of sea level rise in Tuvalu, it's greater than the global rate of sea level. So if we don't do anything that can lessen the mechanism that triggers the sea level from rising, also in a few more years will be no longer used, going to be inundated again. So we must keep on rebuilding and resetting ourselves up. Another thing, like looking at these bigger countries, they have a lot of money, billions or trillions of money they can be investing into, you know, weapons for killing or for security. So if only they can invest that amount to rebuild Tuvalu, that will maintain a very concrete development for the Tuvaluans to be still intact with their land and be on their Tuvaluan land rather than be like relocating elsewhere and also taking other challenges when they move places that they may be classed as alien residents in those areas also.
And Richard has traveled the world to beat the drum for his beloved nation. I asked him whether all his activism was having an influence. He wasn't sure.
At times, we often feel with their facial expression that they really felt sorry for us, what we are going through because of the impact of climate change. And at some point, like others will say, I think I have to visit and to see Tuvalu. But we don't know other people, but what I always take into my mind, like seeing other people who just quiet, listening to us and like observing our stories, what we are telling them. I think they're not very trusting, or they don't really think that we are telling the truth. Maybe they're just saying we're just making a lot of noise, but it's not the reality of it. And very hard to convince people. But the good thing is that whether they listen or they don't listen, as long as we have given our voices out, expressing the climate issues that we are facing, and with the hope that they will one day make an effort to reach out to Tuvalu, to live in Tuvalu for a month or more, just to experience what we have been telling them. It's really a fade-up issue, like how many more stories do you want to hear, and how many more feasibility studies do you want to conduct in Tuvalu about climate change? We have enough of talking and enough of data to provide, but what we need to do is implementation, and we need support, financial support for development.
I then asked Richard about all the attention that had been given to Tuvalu, attention from Australia, attention from the United States, attention from China, attention from Taiwan. Are Tuvaluans happy with all this attention? Are they basking in it? Or are they not happy about it? And he began by answering about the Falapeli Union.
Honestly speaking, when this treaty came up to be announced and talkings over the radios about this treaty with Australian, many Tuvaluans were really excited about that. Some of them, they said, no, I haven't really been given a whole percentage, like to have a collection of data to see the rate of those who don't like the treaty itself. And feeling about the attention of this big country into Tuvalu, like many Tuvaluans feel happy, especially during the war. I'm just reflecting back, like during the war, when Second World War, when America was here in Tuvalu, that was a really thankful times for Tuvalu, because the Americans was here to protect the country. And so they looking at every government that look into Tuvalu as a good thing, in a way that we know there are people who are concerned to give something good for Tuvalu at this crisis that we are facing. The people of Tuvalu, they welcome the support that is given, but there are some are overreacted without critically thinking of what can happen. So this area has to be explained well to the people of Tuvalu.
China takes PIC's special conditions and concerns on climate change very seriously and has been committed to helping them strengthen capacity to tackle climate change. In April 2022, the China Pacific Island Countries Climate Change Cooperation Center was officially launched in Shandong Province of China. Since 2019, China has held three South-to-South cooperation training sessions for PICs under the theme of Tackling Climate Change for Green and Low Carbon Development. China has also provided multiple batches of supplies to PICs to tackle climate change. China has attached importance to strengthening renewable energy cooperation with PICs and supported Chinese enterprises in joining the construction of hydropower stations in countries such as PNG and Fiji.
So climate change is clearly a major stated priority of Pacific Island nations. How are they engaging with China on the issue? How is China engaging with the Pacific on the issue? We spoke with a researcher well-placed to know the answers.
Bolavinaka, Ramitesh Kant, from Fiji. I've been an academic at the University of the South Pacific for over 10 years now. Currently based at the Australian National University, pursuing my PhD. So the research project was led by Dr. Tess Newton-Gain from the Griffith Asia Institute. And the main objective of the research was to look at China's engagement in the Pacific in the context of climate change. So we focused on three countries, looking at Samoa, Vanuatu, and Papua New Guinea, and regional institutions mainly based in Suva. So our intention was to talk to policymakers in these three case countries and regional policymakers as well.
And the main findings of the research project, as Romitesh relayed them, surprised me.
Basically, the first one was that Pacific Island countries and the three case studies that we had, the governments, when they initiate conversations with China, climate change does not feature as prominently as we would like to think. When Pacific Island officials have conversations with China on development, climate change does not really feature as one of the most prominent area that requires attention. A lot of focus is on infrastructure development, South-South cooperation in terms of the traditional development needs as opposed to climate change. However, it's not to say that China does not engage in climate change. It does. It provides disaster response. It's slowly indicating that there is a shift, that China is paying a bit more attention, and it could be related to the fact that Pacific Island countries are slowly engaging China on climate change. The second one was that the bilateral relationship between China and Pacific Island countries is primarily focused on short-term economic and infrastructure projects, and critical conversations around environment and climate change are missing from this or misaligned with the long-term regional objective where climate change is enshrined as the single greatest security threat in the region. And the third one was that the research basically found that there is potential for meaningful impact. So as we were wrapping up our interviews with stakeholders, what came to the fore was that China started to make statements around China Pacific Island Countries Climate Change Cooperation Research Center. Also, that China contributed to the Pacific Resilience Facility initiated by the Regional Forum. So there were sort of moves in 2020, 2021, and it intensified in 2022 that China was starting to play or put climate change as an important area of engagement with the Pacific.
That's fascinating. I mean, were you surprised by these findings? I mean, the dominant beat one hears from the Pacific is the importance of climate change. And yet what you're telling me is when Pacific Island leaders engage with China, it's not a front and center issue. It's not a top line issue.
Yeah, and I think it's also to do with the fact that the regional architecture or forum secretariat, while climate change is listed or classified as the single greatest security threat, there is a sort of a disconnect between domestic politics and regional politics as well. I mean, being from Fiji, I know for a fact that when it comes to climate change conversations around elections, you know, climate change does not really feature as, you know, the number one priority or featuring the top three or top five list of priorities as well. So I guess there's a definite need to actually look at the domestic politics of climate change and how it features in the national conversations.
This conversation with Ramitesh and all the others for this episode laid bare for me the realities of statecraft and how they cut across the domestic and international political spheres. Climate change is the major ever-present issue faced by all in the Pacific Islands. At the same time, states are balancing it with other imperatives, which in a lot of the Pacific means infrastructure and taking advantage of the Pacific presently being a buyer's market when it comes to influence. The states of the Pacific are acting as all states do when it comes to the great game of statecraft, which is to look after their own interests first and foremost. Next episode, we look to the nuclear ghosts of the Cold War that continue to haunt this region and how much it impacts upon today's statecraft. I'm Gordon Peake, the host and word crafter of Statecraftiness. Luther Knut is the sound crafter, and the executive production crafters are Joanne Wallace, Mark Nataras, and Shanna Ryan. With thanks to Wing Kuang for voicing the Chinese official. We wonder if you could do us a favor and leave us a rating or review on your podcast app of choice. Or if you've enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends, family, and fellow statecraft aficionados. This activity was supported by the Australian government through a grant by the Australian Department of Defence to the University of Adelaide. The views expressed are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Australian government, the Australian Department of Defence, or the University of Adelaide.